Good morning. So most of us are sitting here for a day or two, and that's pretty wonderful. It may not always feel wonderful to you, may not always feel wonderful to me, but it is wonderful. Underneath, it's wonderful. In here, it's wonderful. This talk today is the second talk of a three-part series that I'm giving on deepening and strengthening meditation. The assumption being that everybody here has been through intro to meditation here or someplace else and has some kind of a meditation practice already, some kind. The definition can be as broad as you'd like it to be. That's fine. You're making that effort. So, in my first talk, I talked about the complementary relationship in classical Buddhist meditation between concentration and bare awareness. Concentration, narrowing the focus, and bare awareness, broadening the focus so that it includes everything. And how those two are really necessary. Both of those are necessary if we want to strengthen and deepen our meditation and really enjoy our lives. This is what this is about, learning to enjoy our lives. I won't talk about it. Well, maybe I'll talk a little bit about that today. See, I have you as a captive audience, and I don't have to worry about the time. So on tomorrow, I'm going to have to have the clock right in front of me. Concentration. We need to concentrate sometimes because our mind is too scattered to really just be like this, just to be an ear, just to be an eye, just to be sensing. So we do concentration meditation. We narrow our focus just on our breath, just on picking up the cup, just on the feeling of the cup. But we do that because of the static that prevents us from just doing bare awareness, openness, where there's nothing except everything. There's nothing except life and vision, but vision, not some fancy vision, just seeing light, hearing sounds, feeling things. So back and forth. And of course, the Tibetans will say that first you have to do concentration meditation for so many years, and then you're ready for bare awareness, which they have a word for, but I've forgotten it. You guys know. Some of you know. But, you know, I don't think so. That's fine, but I don't think so. Even after practicing for 83 years, or however many years I've been practicing, sometimes I need to really concentrate because something's on my mind. And that's good. And sometimes I'm too scattered to do bare awareness. So you could say it's more advanced, but we're not interested in advancing. We're interested in being present in our world, in our life, and not be mesmerized by this incessant chattering that is actually painful. It's painful. So I'm going to talk today about five impediments that I've just noticed and observed in myself and by talking to people for years strengthening and deepening. And I'll talk more about the last one. They're simple. They're really simple, you guys. You know them probably better than I. Drowsiness. Now, I didn't see anybody look like they were nodding off this morning. We had a lot of walking meditation. Maybe you've been doing a lot of caffeine. I don't know. I don't control your caffeine intake. But after lunch, if you eat a big lunch, wait and see. Drowsiness. So what's the deal there? Well, first of all, it's not bad. Don't get wigged out about it. Don't think your meditation's... It means you're relaxed enough to be drowsy. That's pretty good. You're that relaxed to be drowsy. And you know, we associate turning the mind inward with going to sleep. So we associate that as human beings. When we want to go to sleep, we turn the mind inward. So it's pretty natural for you to get drowsy at times. And we're used to high stimulation. Something is always, we've got to do something. We've got to take care of this child or drive on the road in a way that isn't too fast or isn't too slow. We've always got to do something. And more our culture is like that. There's always something to do. So we're used to high stimulation. And when we're not there, there's nothing to do except sit and look at a wall. We yawn. And we don't want anybody to see that we're yawning. But inside we go, oh, that's okay. That's natural. That's natural. The Indian meditation teachers talk about trying to train an elephant, a baby elephant. And they say, you train a baby elephant by tying the baby elephant to a post. And it lunges from one direction. It lunges to another direction. It lunges, it lunges, it lunges. Finally, it just gives up and goes to sleep. So we lunge. You ever notice how you lunge at something? You lunge, you lunge, you lunge. And then here, you're just here with nothing. Well, what's there to do? Or you could keep lunging at your practice at trying to do it better. But maybe then you just give up and go to sleep. So, natural, natural. So, I don't have much to say about this one, except get enough sleep at night and don't meditate after activities that are really stimulating or directly after them. Don't meditate after a big meal. Don't eat too much in retreat, because if you do, you know, all kinds of things could happen. Eat enough, but just don't eat too much. If I were continually on retreat, I would lose this belly that I seem to have gotten the last 10 years. It would just go away. But here it is. Well, that's the first one, drowsiness. No big deal. Second one, weak concentration and mind wandering. Yes, yes, yes. Weak concentration and mind wandering. Everybody experiences that. Everyone. And so I say, what I say over and over to people is, it's the nature of the mind to wander. It's the nature of the mind to wander. The mind is looking for something more interesting, more important, more exciting, more novel, to increase its pleasure and reduce its pain. That's what the mind does. To promote our well-being. So we so quickly let go of our breathing, let go of what we're doing, and just wander off. Well, why? It's all about surviving and reproducing. That's what we do. We want to survive. We want to reproduce. We're hardwired, right? It's instinctual, and so our mind is wandering to whatever that object is, whatever that feeling is, whatever that thought is, that will help us survive and reproduce. But concentrated attention is important for survival too. So luckily, it's important for survival too. And we've learned, you guys I hope have learned by now, that you can't scold the mind into calming down. You can't scold the mind into being present. You can scold the mind all you want. But I've used the analogy for years of the puppy. I went to a retreat with Jack Kornfield in 1980. So I'm an old guy. He was about my age, but he led the retreat. And he talked about the puppy. And that was his meditation instruction were all about. How many of you heard me talk about the puppy before? Raise your hand. Well, some of you haven't. Well, I'll talk about the puppy then. Only four of you, huh? So, when you have a puppy, you've just got your new puppy, and you're training the puppy to stay by you. You want the puppy to stay with you. You love the puppy. But the puppy is always wandering off. The puppy's into the chewing up the sofa, peeing on the bed, looking for food in the garbage. Ever had a little puppy like that? Do you love the puppy? Then you call the puppy back. Do you hit the puppy? If you hit the puppy's not going to come back. Puppy doesn't want to come back. And you don't want a cow puppy anyway, do you? Do you want a cowed puppy? A puppy that doesn't have any spirit? Didn't you get the puppy because you love this puppy's spirit? So, gently and lovingly bring the puppy back. Do it 84,000 times. And then the puppy starts to stay. On the 85,000th time, there it is. And it's just licking you. It feels so good. Wow. 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 So that's all you need to do for weak concentration and mind wandering. That's all you need to do. Like a muscle, we're developing our meditation muscle. The more we do it, the more our unconscious does it automatically. And if you want to, you can even turn it into a game. Now, Dogen would not like this, but Dogen's been dead for about 700 years. So. You can turn this into a game. You can say to yourself, oh, I'm going to see, and some of you do this already, how many numbers I can count to with my breathing before my mind just gets blotto out there. And, you know, people try this and they say, well, sometimes I get to two. And then one time I got to three. So don't judge yourself if you get to make it a game. Maybe you'll get to 2.5. Maybe it'll always just be one. Well, one's fine. One's the primal number anyway. Everything's included in one. So if you keep getting to one, that's good. Maybe you don't even get to one. But you do. All you have to do is say one. It's here, right? So, weak concentration and mind wandering. Our goal is to catch our distractions before they become too gross, right? And as our mind gets stiller, in a retreat, your mind will get stiller. Now, I'm not guaranteeing that it'll get stiller after so many sits. It really depends on what you're bringing into the retreat in terms of stuff that's on your mind. But anyway, the mind will get stiller if you keep doing retreat. It does get stiller. But what happens when it gets stiller? More thoughts, more memories come up. More emotion, sometimes raw emotion that we didn't even... Where's that come from? Because our mind is still. So stuff is coming out of our storehouse unconscious. Stuff is coming out of it. And so as our bare awareness becomes more spacious, and we're more aware of the sounds and sights around us and the feelings in our body, more background material that's there in our unconscious, in our storehouse unconscious, just comes up. And if something comes up, something kind of weird that you didn't even know was there, some feeling or something, you just let it come up, and bring the puppy back, bring it back. So, and you know this, but I'm reminding you this anyway. Stilling the mind is not getting rid of thoughts. It's not blocking distractions. It's reducing your identification with that stuff. It's just stuff. And you can use... anything you want to bring yourself back. You can use a word. You can use your breath. You can come back to your sensations. So years ago, when I did a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat, I was not as long ago as I did the Jack Kornfield retreat, but a long time ago. He had us do, and I've suggested this to some of you, he had us do, when our minds were really wigging out, he had us do present moment on the in-breath, only moment on the out-breath. Or he had us do deep on the in-breath, peace on the out-breath. That's fine. You can make that your sacred mantra. You can make anything your sacred mantra, anything that helps you come back. You can do a TM mantra. Sure, why not? If you have one that you really, that is in your heart, sure, sure. We're not exclusive here. Bare awareness is not exclusive. The next one is impatience. The third one is impatience. We want something from our practice. You gave up your good Saturday to come here. All the things you should have been doing at home. Being with your partner, being with your kids, mowing the lawn, whatever you should have been doing. You want something. It's already 10:20. And have you wasted all the time? You want something. You want something. We want something. And what's the antidote to that? Well, I don't know what the antidote is, but one antidote is to just try to enjoy our moments here. Enjoy our moments. That's why don't be macho about your posture. Sit in chairs. Don't be macho about anything. And if tension comes up, just breathe into it and give it a little love. Give it a little love. Give it the love you give your grandchild or your favorite niece. Give it that love. Or your favorite dog. Your new puppy. Give it the love. Give it love. Give it love. Because there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. Absolutely nowhere. Which is everywhere. It's everywhere. So the fourth one, physical pain and discomfort. Physical pain and discomfort and emotional pain and discomfort is the fourth ones. Physical pain and discomfort. Okay, so this is a pretty easy retreat. This is pretty easy. But in terms of physical pain and discomfort, because we have all this walking. But you still might have physical pain and discomfort. You still might. I had a little this morning. We're not used to long sitting. Even those of us who lead retreats here, I'm less used to it than I used to be, because I used to lead all the long retreats here. You know, 12 a year or whatever, however many. Maybe we didn't have 12 then. Plus long, several day ones. So we're not used to long sitting. And then when even a little itch comes up, or a little pain in the shoulder comes up, we magnify it. We don't have anything else to think about. We don't have anything else to pay attention to. So we magnify it. It magnifies itself because it captures our attention. And so our goal is just to put it aside. Just to put it aside. And sometimes we can do that pretty easily. If we keep doing it. Sometimes it can't. We can't put it aside. And then what do? We make it our meditation object. We make it our meditation object. This sharp pain in my shoulder, which is piercing me all the way, maybe it's burning, maybe it's dull, maybe it's solid, maybe it's changing, maybe it's fluctuating and moving to my other shoulder and moving up my neck. I'm just my bare awareness. That's just my focus on it. I'm watching it. I'm being with it with an open heart. With an open heart. And it can generate lots of feelings, too. Lots of negative feelings. That's just a part of it. It's just part of it. So that physical pain. Emotional pain. Well, as the mind grows calm and the heart opens, significant stuff may come up, as I said. It may come up. It may not come up. Some people said to me, oh, nothing came up for me in my retreat. Am I doing it wrong? I said, no, this is not psychoanalysis, you guys. This is not psychoanalysis. If nothing comes up, that's fine. Just sit and be present. But for in intensive retreats, especially, stuff often does come up. Emotional stuff comes up. Sometimes significant memories, thoughts. And then, of course, if you really are into your meditation, you're really doing a lot of concentrated meditation, sometimes you can have visions. You're sitting facing the wall. You can have cool visions or scary visions or, referred to as makyo by the Japanese, which is disparaging. But I don't disparage. Sometimes they come up fine. They'll tell you something about your life. So, lots of stuff can come up. Lots of stuff can come up. And is it a sign of progress when stuff comes up? Well, not necessarily, because then you cling. It's just a sign. Just what's happening. Not a progress or not progress. I used to say progress, then everybody wanted those things to happen. So, no progress. No progress. Zero progress. So, bear awareness as long as we can, not indulging or repressing, and whatever it is, whatever the emotion is, it'll subside. It'll subside. Everything subsides. Everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It all subsides. And we remind ourselves that we're safe here. We're safe. We're safe. Our body is still, and you can talk to the Eno, or you can talk to me. You're safe. And then, if the emotion still stays, you can go into your bodily sensations. Because emotion and body are not two. And every emotion has bodily sensations as part of it. So you can just be with it. Notice the density, the hotness, the coolness, how they're moving. So I talked about, I was pointing to this place in my shoulder. So about a few minutes ago when I was talking, so about, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 20, 25, 30 years ago, I was sitting in a long retreat, and I had pain right here, right at this point. And now for some reason, that pain evoked fear, that pain. It seemed very piercing, but it evoked fear, not the way other pain didn't. Didn't seem to evoke pure. That pain did. And now this again was a long retreat where weird stuff happens. It can happen in short retreats too, actually. I was feeling this, and I realized that it felt like a bee sting right here. And then I saw George Bennett in the first grade. I'm in the first grade, and George Bennett has a jar with a bee in it, and he's a mean kid. He is really mean, and he unscrews it and releases it on me, and then runs away laughing and stings me in the shoulder. So I just saw that. I just with that, I experienced it. I let it be, I let it go, and I had some more pain later in my shoulders, but the emotion wasn't there anymore. It just dissipated. These emotions, they just dissipate if you let them be. And you won't necessarily have this kind of experience that I have. You probably will, actually, if you do as many retreats as I've done in my life. But that's cool. That's cool. Because this stuff, we say the storehouse unconscious. Well, they say storehouse consciousness, but I say the storehouse unconscious. It lodges in our body. It's in our body, that stuff. So we experience in our body, we let it be, we honor it, and let it go. It goes. We don't say let it go. We just are with it. Just kindly, opening our hearts. And at any time, we can go back to breathing with deep on the in-breath, peace on the out-breath, or doing a loving-kindness meditation. It's good for everybody who's a meditator to learn a little loving-kindness meditation and practice it, because anytime you might need to do that. You might need to do that to help yourself just enjoy being here, just appreciate being here. So Joseph Goldstein said, it's not how you're feeling that's important when you meditate, it's how you relate to it. And we could say that about life. It's not how you're feeling that is important, it's about how you relate to it. We're, through our meditation, beginning to reprogram the mind. Or we could say the mind is beginning to reprogram itself, because we are doing it. By letting these seeds from our past experience that have lodged in our body, in our heart, in our mind, letting these seeds wither up and die instead of turn into weeds that just prevent us from clearly enjoying each other's company, clearly enjoying our own company. And these seeds have accumulated, depending on how old you are. But by the time you're a certain age, you've got a lot of them. You've got a lot of emotional memories that you project in the world. And you're always projecting. You don't even know you're projecting them. Your whole world, and it becomes a projection of emotional memories. So just to see that and let it be and let it go before the projection turns into something that really overwhelms you. And you come back. You come back to your beginner's mind. As you see the seeds and let them go, you come back to your beginner's mind, to your baby mind, to your enlightenment before you were born, your enlightenment as birth, continually. So the last one I want to talk about today is doubt. And I'm going to talk today about two kinds of doubt, healthy doubt and not so healthy doubt. And tomorrow, mostly in my talk, I'm going to talk about doubt which is not a distraction, which is referred to in Zen as the great doubt. But I'm not going to talk about that today, the great doubt. The great doubt is actually a way of deepening and strengthening meditation. But that's for tomorrow. So healthy doubt. First of all, doubt in Zen and Buddhism, in most of Buddhism, certainly in the Buddhism we practice, is regular, normal doubt is good. It's good. It keeps us from blindly accepting beliefs that are foisted on us by our culture, or beliefs that we think are the one true way. This is the one true belief. But if we sit perfectly in meditation together for the next day, we'll all enter nirvana. And those who sit imperfectly won't, and tough luck for them. We're into this, and or whatever, you know, belief. Whatever belief you have. Blindly accepting or being misled or taken advantage of by belief. Most religion is about belief. And there's a lot of belief in Buddhism too, so be careful. Be careful, really. Be careful, because beliefs paralyze us and they cut us off from each other. They cut us off from life. My grandmother, who was a practicing Catholic, used to talk about, she said to me once, "Oh, you're just a doubting Thomas." You guys know that term? Raise your hand if you know that term. A lot. Are that many of you raised Catholic? Or is it that? Or is it just in the vernacular now? In the vernacular, I guess, huh? But I didn't know. I said, Grandma, what's that mean? And she told me about the Apostle Thomas, who refused to believe that the resurrected Jesus had appeared to the 10 other apostles. And he was put down for that. But then he actually, later, he saw for himself that the resurrected Jesus had appeared to him. So, but anyway, be careful about that belief, too. But being a doubting Thomas is good. We're all fallible. We're all in this together, so all of our beliefs are fallible. They help us to a degree. We need them. But making a teacher, making a Buddha on a pedestal and putting yourself down, it's not healthy. We know it's not healthy. We know it's not healthy. So healthy doubt. But now I want to talk about a doubt that's not so healthy, that's really an impediment to our practice, which is extreme self-doubt. It's what I talked about in my article in the newsletter, which is out on the porch, the trance of unworthiness. That was from a talk I gave on the trance of unworthiness. And then we did a newsletter article because it happens to so many people who meditate. Now see, since I haven't worked with people who don't meditate, I don't know if it happens to... Well, it happens to a lot of people who are in therapy and people who meditate, because I was a therapist for a while. The trance of unworthiness. That extreme self-doubt paralyzes us. Paralyzes us. We actually develop a faith in our own failure. So that's that doubt. Meditators, people keep meditating, but we find it crippling in our daily lives and in our meditation. It has to do with feeling rejected, feeling ashamed, feeling that we're bad, feeling that we're unlovable. Annie Lamott says, she says, I learned that my mind is a dangerous neighborhood. I learned that my mind is a dangerous neighborhood. I learned that I can't go there alone. Meaning, she needs alcohol or drugs, or she needs a project, or she needs TV, or she needs Twitter, or she needs something. She can't go there alone. A lot of people feel this way. They can't go there alone. And this is different from normal, sort of just falling down. Oh, I failed, I blew it, apologizing, getting up. This is different. This is becomes pervasive. It pervades our psyche, and we still do Zen practice, but it's there lingering as a ghost for so many people that I've worked with over the years, so many people. So how do we get unstuck in a shame response? First of all, how do we get stuck? And then how do we get unstuck? How do we recover a sense of our own goodness? We're good. Buddha said, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. In the beginning, when you're yawning, when you're tired, when your mind is, whoa, good, good, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Our own goodness. We're good because we are. Not because we did this or should do that or he did this or I did that. Because we are. So our negative feelings don't have to hijack us into self-doubt, self-recrimination. They don't have to. They don't have to. We can open our hearts to that being who thinks he is beyond the pale and worthlessness. That little Tim in there who thinks he's beyond the pale and worthlessness. Just open your heart. Bear attention. Bear awareness means opening your heart. That's why I don't use mindfulness. I prefer bare awareness because it has to include the heart and the mind together. our experiences over time create these neural pathways, right? That create our expectations and our habitual responses to experience. Shapes our brain structure. But luckily, the recent research has talked about neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity. But shame begins to be toxic when our innate yearnings to connect, we all want to connect, don't we? To belong, are not met positively. We're criticized, we're judged, we're humiliated for those longings. And then what do? When we're judged, when we're criticized, when we're humiliated, we shut down. We hide. Our yearnings become paired in our neural pathways with what? With heartache. With heartache. So we hunker down. We don't want other people to see it, but inside we hunker down. Hurt. Hiding in an isolated cave. Protecting ourselves against further rejection, further humiliation. I'm so stupid. I'm so stupid, I can't remember anybody's name in here. I barely can remember his name. He's been with me for 11 years. I think it's 11 or is 11 months. I'm so stupid. I'm so incompetent. Can't even sit cross-legged anymore. I'm so unlikable. I must give off a bad aroma. Just being with me, people would pick up on that aroma, even though I bathe 3 times a day. You know, whatever. We do this. We do this. Not all the time, luckily. Not all the time. But a lot of the time we do it. No one will ever love me. Except my puppy. That's why we all want puppies. My puppy loves me. I don't deserve to be loved except by my puppy. So we stay in hiding. We hide out because we don't want to be hurt again. Right? And we may hide out literally, or we may hide out figuratively. And that means we're still in the world, but we're hiding out. All the time we're in the world, we're hiding out. It's a scary world. We're protecting ourselves. And when shaming is repeated and not repaired, it means that over a long time, there was not the feeling from a parent or a partner or a boss or a friend of feeling loved, feeling lovable. There was not that feeling. And so we adapted these shame-based neural pathways, these connections, for survival. We wanted to survive. Scary out there. People do stuff to you. They put you down. Scary out there. So these neural pathways help us survive. But they don't help us grow. They don't help us reconnect with the goodness that's here. Always here. They become repeated and repeated, and they reinforce themselves. And we become imprisoned in these negative loops. So what are the strategies? What are Tim's strategies? Which he gleaned from 83 years of something or other. I'm actually not quite that old. I turned 73 on May 1st. Strategies. Well, Buddhist teaching, Yogacara teaching. We gather wholesome provisions. We want to practice meditation. We want to not be plagued by these seeds. We gather wholesome provisions. And those are referred to as the paramitas. We practice generosity to ourselves. We just are generous to ourselves. We deserve to be generous to ourselves. And if we don't feel like we deserve it, we do it anyway. It's a practice. Because we're trying to cultivate some good emotional memory so we can have some good seeds in there. So that we can really practice together. We can really love each other. We can really be with each other. We gather wholesome provisions, generosity to ourselves, patience with ourselves, patience with ourselves, with others too, but with ourselves if we have shame. So many of us carry it. So many of us carry it. Virtuous behavior toward ourselves. Wholehearted effort to engage in the world, even if it lets you down. Even it will let you down before. It doesn't necessarily going to let you down this time. That's your memory. Give it another try. Do it again. Get out there and do it. So this is called gathering wholesome provisions. Gathering wholesome provisions. We need these provisions on this journey through life. This is not an easy journey. We have to have in our backpack some good food. Some good food. We take out and eat ourselves. Yes, we need to feed others, but we need to feed ourselves so that we can be there for others. Generosity, you guys. Generosity. Kindness. Kindness to yourself. Kindness. Until, if we practice this, we begin to feel okay. If we practice this, we have some good emotional memories from having been generous to ourselves, from having reached out to others and had a good experience. We begin to feel that it's safe to feel okay. I'm not wrong or bad. I did some wrong or bad things, but I'm not wrong or bad. I can and will make conscious, compassionate connection. I will do that. Even though it didn't work 9 times, I'm going to do it the 10th time again. Maybe it will work. I'm going to do that. I'm going to share my provision with him. But I'm going to eat plenty myself so I can really share it with him. That's the first strategy for today. I think I got some more strategies for tomorrow. I don't remember, but I wrote it down. So, second one, bear awareness. That's a strategy. That's the Zen strategy. That's the Buddhist strategy. You can say mindfulness, but I'll say bear awareness. Bear awareness. Shame comes up. Traumatic memories comes up. Boredom comes up from our storehouse, unconscious. And we can even do what the Vipassana people do if we want to. I used to do it. I used to do it after going to, some Vipassana retreat 30 years ago. Naming. Oh, there's a thought. There's a feeling. There's a belief. So just naming your thought when it comes through as a thought. Not getting all intellectual about it. Just thought. You're feeling, I'm feeling tired, naming. Oh, I'm feeling anxious, naming, anxious. That can help you bear awareness if you don't turn it into a religion or a belief system. You've got to be careful about all this stuff. This is about living I don't know about if we're religious, but this is about the preciousness of our lives. And if we have a special religion, we forget the preciousness of our lives. So don't have a special religion. Just tap into that preciousness that's always here. Life is so short, you guys. So short. What are the things you deeply care about? What are the things you deeply want to do? Do them now. Be with it now, generously, open-heartedly. Don't wait until the very end. This is the very end. Remind yourself, this is the end. A new beginning. Wow. A new beginning. Because you don't have to live within that trance of projection. You don't have to live within it. It's made up stuff. I know it gets in your body. It's still made up stuff. So an open, spacious awareness of whatever experience comes up. If it's a pinch in my shoulder and George Bennett is there releasing a bee on me, but just there with it. Just there with it. And he fades away. I wonder what happened to him. He was already already mean in the first grade. Maybe he had some good emotional help. Maybe he had a parent or teacher. One teacher was there for him, so he didn't have to be mean for his whole life. I don't know. I haven't been back to my hometown to find out. Well, even I have been back to my hometown, but I don't know what I did. I didn't look his name up in the phone book. Oh, look that guy up. Can you imagine the first grade? This is really true. He had these bees in a bottle, and these kids he didn't like, the short kids, you know, he went and he released bees on us during recess. And he got away with it. You know, kids get away with stuff. The adults are always trying to monitor, but my grandsons, you know, they get away with stuff. Anyway, we get away with stuff, a lot of stuff. So here, in this meditation hall, instead of imprisoning ourselves, saying bad, when we get away with stuff, our mind goes off, circling someplace, being yesterday or being next week, we just come back, we just bring the cuppy back. So we don't say you're bad for getting away with stuff. You always want to get away with stuff. Everybody does. Just gently come back. Open your heart to it. And what's gone away is here. And you're free from it. You're free from it. Because you're not making a federal case out of it. You're not turning it into anything in particular. So that's naming that the Vipassana folks do, and I used to do it. Naming. You can do that. That's cool. So I want to finish by talking about holding and then doing a holding exercise. So according to the myth, so Buddha was sitting for his last few days before he attains enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, right? And actually when I went to India, they showed me the trees. Is it a banyan tree? I can't remember. It's a wonder. Maybe somebody remembers. It's a wonderful big tree. Does anybody know what it is? Pardon?
That's a banyan tree.
It is a banyan tree? Yeah. Beautiful trees. That really, and India is really hot. India is hot and dusty. I won't get into that. But I went to India because my daughter-in-law is Indian, so I had a wonderful time. But these trees give great shade, and they're like oaks, only these are bigger. And so supposedly Buddha was sitting under one of those when he decided he was going to do zazen the way we do it. Of course, he did exactly the way we did it. We do it, right, Ben?
Yes.
says in the Pali Canon, doesn't it?
Yes.
So he had the tree at his back. He was able to face all these temptations and all the demons of Mara, of that devil, just with the tree at his back. Just with the tree at his back. The tree supporting him. The rootedness going deep into the earth, providing the shade for him. The color of the leaves, the stillness of the trunk, its breath, its depth at his back. Holding. Holding. So now I want to do a little meditation with you on that theme. And this is one I've done before, only I added a whole bunch to it recently. But I did it with Anne and the mental health group the other day. So get in a posture that you're going to sit in for about 10 minutes. Find a steady, stable posture that you're going to sit in for about 10 minutes. Get a chair if you want, or move your cushion or something. No, actually, before you do this, stand up. Everybody who wants to, stand up. You don't have to. And, you know, stretch or whatever you want to do. Okay, and then there's one chair, and if other people want chairs, get chairs. And then whenever you're ready, sit down. No hurry. We've got plenty of time here today. Did you notice that? You don't have to be anywhere except here. And we don't have to be here. It's not a mandate. This is not about mandating you guys. It's just being with. Now, this is a holding meditation. This is a holding meditation. So, first of all, close your eyes three-quarters of the way, or even all the way. It doesn't really matter. And pay attention to your body. And notice that your body, in some ways, resembles a mountain. And you can let the top of your head just gently reach up to the sky at the summit of the mountain. And you can breathe in to the mountain. And notice that your shoulders are in the top part of the mountain. And feel the mountain all the way down to your legs and the floor. Just feeling the mountain and breathing. Just breathing and being a mountain. And whatever happens, the mountain just sits. Sometimes wind, gales of wind even, swarm around the mountain, and the mountain just sits. Sometimes sun rises on the side of the mountain, in the front of the mountain, or maybe in the back of the mountain, and the mountain just sits. Sometimes cold air swirls around the top of the mountain or the bottom of the mountain or some part of the mountain, and the mountain just sits. Sometimes rain pours itself down on the mountain in gales, and the mountain just sits. Sometimes it gets so cold on the mountain that snow covers the entire mountain with a dress, and the mountain just sits. The mountain just sits. Whatever happens, the mountain just sits. And you might notice that someone on the mountain is moving along, maybe a group of people, and maybe they're chattering. Maybe they're making a ruckus. Well, maybe they're not. But the mountain just sits. And then there may be another group of people on the mountain. Maybe they're upset. And then the mountain just sits. And you might even notice that someone on the mountain may be experiencing some anxiety or fear. I wonder what it is that they're feeling. The mountain just sits. As this person identifies and accepts what they're feeling, the mountain just sits. Whatever happens, the mountain just sits. And I wonder where in their body, this person who is experiencing anxiety or fear, where it is in their body. The mountain just sits. They may even be scanning their bodies to discover where it is. The mountain just sits. The mountain just sits. The mountain just sits. And that person on the mountain, or those people on the mountain who have some fear, it might be changing and or moving, but this person can just rest on the mountain. The mountain is very restful. Any fear, any anxiety, any discomfort, the mountain has plenty of room for. Plenty of room for. Because the mountain just sits. And if these people on the mountain who are anxious or afraid, or maybe just a little uncomfortable, want to offer their feelings to the mountain can support whatever they want to give up over to it, because the mountain just sits. And what would it be like for that person or those people to accept or even embrace the fear that they can't give over to the mountain? The mountain just sits. And these people on the mountain, this person on the mountain, may begin to feel very safe, regardless of what's going on, because the mountain just sits. And whether it's a banyan tree or mountain or a big stone in the backyard, it just sits. It just hits. Okay, and I think that's whenever you're ready, you can just come back to the room and we can move on with our next activity. So when you're ready, open your eyes and come back to the room, and I think this will be the end of this activity, and we'll move into the next one.